music. Hi, everybody. This is Jacob Hall, host of the Diecast, reporting to you from oneofus.net. And as always, I'm joined by my loyal co-host, Mr. Daniel Kalbacher. Hi, Daniel. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jacob?
Anyway, we have an all-star special episode of the Diecast. We are joined by the big papa bear of oneofus.net, Mr. Brian Salisbury.
That is on my business card, actually. It's horrifying, and I wish I could change it, but he's, what are you going to do? It's printed, so.
Well, I mean, when you order like 1,000 of them.
Yeah, you got to use them
all.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Papa Bear?
I'm doing quite well, thanks. How are you, Jacob, Mr. Chairman? I feel like you mentioned that.
Well, see, across from him is a Diecast regular, Miss Tony Salisbury. How are you doing, Tony?
I'm pretty great. I'm not going to ask you how you are, because I think the response will be,
Well, And we're also joined by another one of us regular. You know him from his beard, from his jolly personality, and from being the nicest guy in the world, Mr. Luke Mullen.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing, Luke?
You know, I'm doing quite well, Dr. Hall, and I'm not going to ask you how you're doing because I don't give a shit.
And that, nicest ladies guy and in the gentlemen, world. Is how you become the nicest guy in the
world. And we have a returning guest. You haven't seen him since episode 1 or 2, but he's one of my favorite people and a great board gamer, Mr. Paul Gandersman.
Hello. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Last time you were on the show, we were discussing our favorite Gateway board games, I believe.
I remember we were playing that racist game.
Oh. Archipelago?
Yeah.
Archipelago.
That was the same episode, actually.
Oh, okay, yeah. And then we were talking about the intro games. We were talking about Catan and stuff like that.
Are you talking about Archipelago? Because that game is amazing.
Yeah, where you pee on the black people.
And then you get trapped in the closet.
Yeah.
I feel like since we've already brought up racist board games, now is the time to mention Kevin Kelly, who's a good friend of ours from Los Angeles, who's a big board gamer and has a large board game collection. And at one point found in a Goodwill, in fact, a game from the 40s or 50s called Darkies in the Melon Patch.
Oh, good God. Oh, good God.
The cover art is pretty amazing.
No, I don't want to see it. I don't want to see
someone it. Someone on the internet was sharing a board game from the 60s or 70s that was I'm not sure if it was a parody or an extension of Monopoly, but the idea was that players divided into white players and black players.
Oh, and it's chess.
And white players had easier access to money, but when they lost their money, they fell out of the game faster, whereas black players had to work hard to get everything, but held on to it stronger.
That is very odd and unfortunate in a lot of ways.
All right.
Does anybody else kind of want to play?
I kind of want to play that.
Wait, which game? Because you brought up a couple, and one of them I'm terrified to know if that's the one you're talking about.
Of course it is.
Okay, good.
It reminds me of a Puerto Rico, one of the most acclaimed and beloved board games of all time. It's still a game of colonialization, and your workers who you place on your field spaces to bring up your sugar and your cotton are painted black, unfortunately. It's very, very unfortunate European game design. it's like we haven't had slavery in longer than America, so we can do what we want with slavery. Like, no, you can't, guys. You can't do that. It's bad. It's very bad. Okay. So, as usual, on this kind of episode where we have a big group like this, I want to see what you guys have been playing. So, we'll start with you, Paul. What have you been playing recently?
Well, are we going to stick to the topic at the end, anything?
This is whatever you want to talk about.
The last two games I played would be... I guess card or board games would be Hearthstone, and then before that I played Goosebumps, the board game, for ages like 6 and up.
Let's save Hearthstone for later, because that's relevant. Tell us about the Goosebumps board game.
That game is awesome.
Is it a Euro game? Is it about economic resource management?
No, it's about Goosebumps, Terror in the Graveyard.
Yeah, I had this game when I was a kid. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's like you have to like build the board up, and it's got, you know, you move some pieces so like characters can drop in to the board, and then there's, you know, at the end you have to get a magic ring, and then you have to shoot a skull into this thing, and maybe it'll...
This sounds inappropriate for children.
And manage your crops.
Yes, and then manage all of your crops, of course, but no, it's...
And then harvest the souls.
I was playing with a few friends, and we often play a lot of more, adult games, but I had this copy of Goosebumps, and we thought, why not? And there's some really interesting pictures on there, and it came with a little booklet story that was very rapey.
Rapey?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it...
Thank God you weren't playing an adult game.
It was was interesting. I can pull up some of the text here.
While Paul does that, I want to point out that a dog just farted underneath the table. We're all recoiling in horror.
Which is the signal that Paul's story isn't interesting enough.
Josh grabbed Billy, and the two of us pulled him to the ground. No, please, Billy begged. Please don't. A lot of kids beg Josh and me, but we don't pay any attention. We tickle them anyway.
Yeah,
you can go first, Luke, Josh said to me. He held Billy's shoulders to the ground, and I started to tickle his ribs. Stop, please. Stop, please, Billy begged. He started to kick both legs. But you can't squirm away from Josh and me. We know what we're doing. I tickled Billy with both hands, digging my fingers into his sides. He started laughing and begging and kicking and squirming at the same time.
Christ.
Sure, it's mean, but it's also fun. I tickled the poor kid till he could barely breathe. Then Josh took over. The laugh police strike again, I shouted. That's what Josh and I call ourselves, the laugh police. That's because we like to tickle kids and make them laugh until they beg for mercy. So yeah, it was real rapey.
The game was fun. Actually, that helped me contextualize a really traumatic experience from my childhood.
Jacob.
Thanks, Goosebumps Terror in the Graveyard.
As the site administrator, I have never listened to this show. Is this the is this the kind of thing you always open with?
Well,
is like child rape
this
and
is why
melon
I don't get invited
patches
very
and,
often.
Okay.
Well, the unsung truth of board games is that they're all full of rape.
Oh.
All of them.
Good.
I mean, which one? Monopoly? Please.
Settlers of Race Catan? Car?
Monopoly, more like Ontopoly, right? High fives. Yeah.
Self five.
I don't care. I'll take it.
Well, we're going to move on from Paul's rapey goosebump story.
It's really good. You should try and find a copy and play it.
And we're moving on to Mr. Luke Mullen. Luke, what have you played recently that's not the Game of Thrones card game?
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's kind of dominated most of our game playing time recently. But actually, you came over the other day, and we did play a little bit of Escape, which is a fun co-op game.
Well, tell us about Escape for people at home who have not played it.
So Escape is a team game where you all are trying to escape from an ancient thimble, Indiana Jones style.
I
didn't know what the hell
enough
it was.
Not to point out because I figured people would get it.
As the site administrator, I do not know what politeness is, but I will take your.
I
want to
play the
suggestion.
Shut up, Papa Bear. So anyway, it's this co-op game, and it's actually you use like CD or an MP3. So it's timed, and there's this creepy, you know, temple music going on. And you are exploring outwards. So you start on like a tile, and you have to. You each have 5 dice with various symbols on them, and you have to roll certain symbols to move out of the room you're in and into the next room and explore different rooms. And then, if you want to, you can get really crazy and involve curses and treasures and all kinds of fun things like that. So basically, yeah, you're all trying to escape from this temple. And
that sounds fun.
You have like 10 minutes to do it. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a quick game, but very enjoyable.
Wait, 10 minutes in real time?
Yeah.
10 minutes in real time, everybody plays simultaneously.
Huh.
So it's...
So you're all rolling at the same time and yelling at each other.
Lots of shits and fucks.
Lots of shits and fucks.
And if we recorded a game of Escape for this podcast, it'd be almost entirely shit and fuck, I've been locked out. Because that's what happens is that you roll your dice, and if you roll a black-sided die... You can't roll the die anymore.
Of course.
Until you roll a gold-sided die to cure that dice and get it back in your hand.
This is the most racist podcast since the last podcast we published on oneofus.net.
Mostly unintentional.
Yeah, unintentional racism is the funniest type of racism.
Well, it should be said that every other episode of the diecast is entirely black people. This is the first time we're entirely white people on the table.
Is that true? I feel like that's completely not true.
Remember that time we had the person who was not white on the show, guys?
Yeah, I mean, like, all the time, right?
Okay, this is cool.
now it's just bad.
Just moving on from that.
I'm real white, FYI. Like, it's not even close.
He's real white, not fake white.
Anyway.
Not even off-white.
What's Elliot doing tonight?
Hating all of us, and he doesn't know why.
You know one black person. And you just name-dropped him.
If you're trying, if you turn in right now, there's a strong chance you cut out all the racist bits that preceded this. Daniel, what have you played recently?
Let's see. Last night, actually, I played City of Remnants for the first time.
And what did you think of City of Remnants?
Oh, boy, that is a game. I guess...
Wait, what? What are we doing on this podcast?
I thought we were talking about Pogs. Are we not talking about Pogs?
I wish.
All right.
Alf is back in Pog form.
Pogs. Awesome.
So yeah, the backstory of City of Remnants is that Earth is over. A bunch of aliens came to Earth, killed most people, then took the survivors to a slum on their alien world, where they put the survivors of every other genocide they've committed. And instead of, you know, all the alien races banding together to defeat their oppressors and maybe get out of the slum...
They rape them?
Well, they form racist street gangs.
Oh, okay.
And become mafia dons. And it's just a bad projection of what we could be.
So it's pretty much, to give you an idea of City of Remnants, you are literally building up your alien street gang, building businesses based on prostitution, gambling, gun running, and you have to defend yourself against alien cops every so often. So the idea is you're working against each other to build a successful criminal enterprise while trying to work underneath the noses of the alien police officers who routinely will sweep across the entire board and try to kill you. And it's games really, really balanced, interestingly, because you have to learn to work together while kill each other. Because you can't just... Going entirely on the offensive is a good way to lose that game.
Oh, yeah. And well, what's really interesting is that there's four players, four separate colors. And at the beginning of the game, we all picked a color. I had no idea that this meant that not just it's, oh, I was the blue player, but actually that, oh, my blue player plays completely different from red player, completely different from green player, completely different from yellow player. And so everyone gets a built-in strategy that they have to kind of figure out on their own. Like, there's no real guide on your little player mat or anything like that. It's just like, here's some cards, figure out how you're going to deal with this.
And speaking of, we'll get into card games and deck building momentarily, but City of Remnants is interesting because it's an area control war game in a sense, but it also has elements of deck building because you have little guys on the board who are your armies and who you're fighting with, but you're... Everything in terms of battles, in terms of playing abilities, is done with a hand of cards. And you are building a deck and buying cards and constantly, like, using these cards to actually get the game going. So it's a war game powered by a deck building engine, which is actually, it's literally, the game designers took about five or six different things that they like. They like area control, like economic resource management, they like war games, like deck building, like auctioneering, and they just combine them all into this kind of a design that seems unwieldy at first until it clicks.
Oh yeah, and I feel like for everyone at the table, it started clicking around round three or so, and at that point, it was like, oh, I need to be purchasing these cards for my deck, but I also need to be building things over here and blocking Jacob from buying those cards, but at the same time, making money for myself. And there's a lot of things to do.
All right, so moving on to Tony. Tony, what have you played recently?
It's not what I've played recently, it's what I've played, or what I haven't played recently, which is, we started a game of Risk Legacy, I would say about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and, that's been heavy on my mind recently, because we haven't gotten through it. We got about halfway through, and realized that, we were no longer friends, that we were countries, damn it, and we hated each other at that game.
I feel like she's calling you out, Jacob.
So I really want to go back. I want to get the group together and
see... You
want to
hate your friends again?
I want to hate my friends again, pretty much. I haven't seen a lot of them to hate.
Hasn't Game of Thrones already done that for you?
I do hate everyone at this table, that's true. But,
okay.
But, except you, Paul. I haven't really played Game of Thrones with you yet.
Yeah.
I just hate you for different reasons.
But the big difference between... Once Game of Thrones is over, though, it's over. Dude, the slate is wet clean. And it's Legacy. The big thing with that game is that you make permanent changes to the board. You write on the board, you tear up cards, you destroy pieces, you make things inaccessible. If someone is commanding the Ukraine very powerfully, you can gain the ability to put a sticker on Ukraine that causes it to lose half its power.
Haha, spoiler alert, nobody controls Ukraine.
I was going to say, it's the Putin sticker that you put on it. Bam, all your power is gone. It belonged to us.
So, unlike Game of Thrones, if you piss somebody off in the last game, chances are it's causing them to linger on the board, and those grudges stay there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mean game.
It is a mean game. And I've had dreams about what that card at the back of the box says, the do not open this ever card.
I've played two separate Risk Legacy games, finished neither of them, and I have never seen that fucking card at the bottom of the box.
Yeah, what they're talking about is the open Risk Legacy, there's basic components, but it's also a series of sealed envelopes and compartments that say, open this compartment, open this envelope when this happens in the game. So the idea is that You can go 6 games, and none of those will happen. Then something circumstances as listed on them will happen. You open it, there's new rules or new cards, something that changes the game entirely. Hidden away in the back of the box, underneath everything, you have to actually have to search to find it.
You have to lift the tray containing all of your pieces and everything. Like, you have to think to lift the tray.
Well, that's what I always do when I open a game box. I mean, who doesn't?
But,
I wasn't joking, actually. But anyway.
This envelope says, do not open ever. Do not open, period, ever.
Period.
from what I understand, the idea is that nothing in the game will cause you to open it, but if you do open it, something very bad lurks inside of there. So,
Bad things.
I'm sure you could find out what it says on the internet, but I don't want to know.
Guys, it's just old Bazooka Joe gum. That's all that's in there. It's not a big deal.
An interesting thing, actually, we had, in the game, there's nothing that causes you to open that card. So we decided among, I believe it's, the five players who are playing the game, our group.
Do you now hate those people, just as an aside?
I mean, I kind of did for a little while,
He doesn't not hate them.
Continue. I don't not hate them. But, one of the thing we decided on was that, all right, the risk of someone becoming too powerful in this game is actually pretty high. That's, like, a thing we had, figured out over time. It's like, someone's going to get on a roll and start, like, kind of sweeping everything, and you have to fight back. So we decided we needed a UN Security Council vote on whenever we wanted to open that card. And we came so close so many times. I believe we decided we needed four out of five votes to open that card. And we got three votes, three separate people votes, like, several times. But never the four. Never the four.
But speaking of the envelope, I've never actually spoiled myself as to what's in it, but I have learned that there are a series of different things it could be. So even if you think it's spoiled, there are number. It could be one of those several things.
Oh, so they put different ones in different boxes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
I like that idea a lot.
Yeah. All
right, so now we've finished our little round table bullshit. It's time to move on to the real conversation of the day.
Brian doesn't play games.
Yeah, it's fine.
Oh, Brian.
Hi, how's it going? Brian.
What about Big Papa Bear?
What's up?
Oh, I forgot about Big Papa Bear. Big Papa Bear is manning the soundboard stuff. So he's a person.
That's why it sucks. But yeah, the thing that I played most recently that isn't the thing we're going to talk about was Avalon, which I enjoyed quite a bit. Which is very much like is that what it was called?
It's the Resistance : Avalon.
Yeah, the Resistance Avalon. It was sort of like Resistance, except it took place in medieval times, and there were a lot more.
Wizards and shit?
What?
Wizards and shit?
There was, literally, wizards and shit.
And shit.
Yeah.
And shit.
Yeah, you actually
it's
have
medieval
to...
medieval times. It's everywhere.
You have to scrape plague victims off the street. It's
nice.
Incredible.
Good.
But no, there were a lot of, like, moving parts to it. There were a lot of components that weren't a part of Resistance that made it a lot more interesting. So, yes, I very much enjoyed that game.
I think Avalon... the Resistance, still my favorite games of all time, but Resistance Avalon, I think, takes a really great game and makes it perfect.
True dat, bruv.
And to be fair, Vanilla Resistance, which is sci-fi theme, now has optional cards you can purchase to beef it up to make it more like Resistance Avalon. But Avalon still has nicer components, it has better art, everything about it is a better game, it's a bigger bang for your buck.
Right. I like to bang bucks.
Yeah, you do.
Snap.
Papa Bear.
Snap.
Crackle.
Pop. Bear. Papa. Papa Bear. Okay.
Okay.
So the reason I've gathered all of you here today is to talk about deck building games. And
keep your hands off my deck, Jacob.
To be more specific, talking about collectible and living deck building games, because there are games like Dominion where there's a base game and you build your deck in the process of playing the game. Everyone turns their cards to the middle, and that's entire like package. We're talking about games where you have to go out and buy additional things and are always constantly changing your deck and bring something completely new to the table. And watching the light go out of your eyes as you learn that your deck that you've been building for weeks doesn't work.
Comma, Tony.
You actually have to tell people when they ask you, what are you doing today? I'm going to Dragon's Lair to buy expansion packs for my Game of Thrones collectible card game. So have achieved uber nerd status. Thank you very much.
So let's talk about collectible card games, and more specifically, living card games, which is why one reason why Paul is here is because Paul has playing experience with both. A collectible card game or a CCG is like Magic or the Pokemon card game that's still popular somehow.
I've played both. Extensively.
Where you buy some big packs, but you also, in order to get more cards, you go buy individual little packs containing seven randomized cards, and you never know what you're going to get.
So.
Yeah, 7 to 10, roughly.
Depends on the game.
And the idea is you're paying $3 or $4 per pack to get random cards, and you're just grabbing them and hoping to get what you want, and building out with what you have available. Living card games, which were created by Fantasy Flight Games, of which there are now several, which include the Game of Thrones card game, which is our bread and butter at this table right now, Netrunner, Call of Cthulhu, Lord of the Rings, Warhammer Invasion.
Star Wars.
And Star Wars. There are games where you buy the big box that's pretty much playable out of it. You can just play casually with the main box. Then there are monthly expansions that release 60 new cards, but you always know what's in those boxes before you pick them up. So you can say, hey, I know I don't want this expansion, or I want this one, or I want two copies of this one. The idea being that you are 100% aware of what you're buying, and there's no random chance involved like there is in Magic. So I want to start with you, Paul, since you've been playing Magic. You played Magic for quite some time, didn't you?
Since I was a kid.
All right, so now that you are a grown man with financial obligations.
Sure. Why not?
Does Magic still work for you? Because it feels like such a money sink to me sometimes.
Is Magic still Magic?
I'm not going to answer that. I go through waves on Magic where I'll play it for a bunch and then just have to walk away. Magic costs a lot of money to play. I mean, it's what you were saying, like with a living card game, like you'll buy the box for like $40 and it has everything you need, and then you can eventually grow out of that, like buying more expansion packs and that sort of thing. I mean, with a CCG or customizable card game, people also call it collectible card game, it depends.
Potato, tomato.
Yeah. Like Magic, Pokemon, many, many others.
Warcraft.
Yeah, they actually stopped publishing that.
I never paid attention to it. I didn't know it was more.
I've played that one as well, which is fun. Basically, you know, you buy like a starter deck for like $15, and it's very basic, very simple. And then you play with somebody, and
they destroy you.
Well, you hopefully play with someone else using a starter deck. But the thing about those is that it's very, you want more very quickly. You buy one of the thing I love about the living card games is that you buy that box, and there's a ton of awesome cards in it already. You've got a lot to play through before you want to start breaking out. An intro deck for like Magic or Pokemon, you play like three games, you're like, okay, I get it. Now I need some more stuff. And so it's very tricky because you go and you buy a booster pack for $3.99 and you get random cards and then you just hope that they'll work. And they, you know, Magic, it's there's five different colors of Magic. And so it's, you know, you might get two usable cards for the type of deck you're trying to build in that pack.
Yeah, when I used to work at Dragon's Lair, the Austin's... honestly, still the best comic and gaming store. I would work Friday nights, which was Magic Night. And they had the big tournaments, and people would come in, and they would play for hours and hours and hours. Then you'd see people walk up to the counter after games are over. Looks of defeat and sadness on their eyes. They buy $150 worth of packs, open them, throw most of the cards on the floor because they didn't need them, and walk away with the two cards that they needed.
Magic definitely fills, and CCGs in general, fill that kind of gambling need, like, that people had. It very much is a gambling type of thing when you're buying packs of cards. I don't want to talk smack about CCGs in general, because I've had many years of fun with them. They're just a very expensive thing and a very different kind of a beast, and so that's why I kind of go waves through it, because I start spending a bunch of money and go, okay, I can't afford to keep doing this. I need to take a break. And that's why I really love the model that Fantasy Flight's doing, and especially with Pokemon, with CCGs, because Pokemon is just evil the way it's designed, where if you get one good card, there's like six other cards you need in order for that card to even be usable in your deck, like required for you to like have it, because you have to like evolve into it with like four copies of this, three copies of this, one of this, and it's like, it's insane. Like, yeah, I got this one card, now I have to get six more before I can do anything with it. But anyway, sorry, you were saying.
Oh, I was going to say, the Jacob scenario there of, you know, you, in the place, he sees a bunch of people buying some cards, they leave with two and throw the rest of them on the floor. Isn't that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I have no experience in this, but isn't that what the whole draft night thing is supposed to prevent?
Well, drafting is an interesting format that most CCGs have some kind of a format for, where basically, let's say we were all playing Magic, we would all show up to the table with three booster packs. Open the first one, draft a card, and then pass the cards to the next person. And then you draft, you literally draft your deck. And then that's an interesting format because everybody's on a level playing field, and you get to keep cards out of it. But, you know, it's still...
The thing I'd always found interesting about it was that, you know, it's like, obviously you're there with a group of people, you're all, you know, buying cards, and once again, I have no real experience with this other than hearing from other friends who have done it. But it was interesting in that it was a way to try, at least try a little harder to get some of the cards you wanted out of that.
Yeah.
Does that often happen, or is it just like, oh, I've ended up with these cards and that's nice, but whatever, I had some fun that night.
A bit of column A, a bit of column B. Okay. Some people draft and they're building a deck and then they open a pack and there's like a $50 card in there and they're just like, oh, well, I'm picking this. Because even though it's not going to do anything to my deck, it's a $50 card. That's the other thing about CCGs is that, you know, these cards in the living card games, they only have the value of what you paid for them. Customizable or collectible card games, there's random percentages for certain types of cards, and there are cards that you can open a pack for $3.99 and get a card that you can sell for $100, just like that.
See, that's always been really interesting to me, because I actually remember when I went to college, there was a small comic book and eventually gaming store that was pretty much like right next to one of the buildings on campus. I remember going in there to set up my monthly pull list because I was like, I'm at a new place, I'm going to get my comics every Wednesday, this is going to be great. And I saw this case full of Magic cards that were all priced, you know, they're all priced very high for a piece of, you know, cardboard.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, Magic's still a thing? And then I come to find out that apparently on our campus there was a thriving Magic scene, and all of these people would go in there and drop like $30 on a card they couldn't find, $50 on a card they couldn't find, just to get their deck going. And that always seemed kind of astonishing to me as I paid the $50 every week for my comic books.
Do you want to hear my favorite Magic story?
Do it.
When I looked at my Magic cards when I moved to a new apartment, and I said, why the hell do I have all these Magic cards? I don't like this game. And I said, I'm going to sell them. And I took them to a collectible card game store, and the guy who bought them from me was so angry I was selling my collection, because he realized, I'm buying these from you, but I'm losing a customer. And he gave me a stink eye the entire time. That's my favorite Magic story.
Oh my god. Wow.
My stepdad was a clown. That's a kind of magic.
What?
My stepdad was a clown.
That's your favorite Magic story?
That's it.
That would be the scariest Magic story.
The other interesting thing that I want to mention real quick about CCGs, and specifically Magic in general, Magic was started in 93.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been cards coming out since 1993. And they release a handful of expansions like a year.
Yeah.
With, you know, here's 250, 300 new cards every time. So they have different types of tournaments. There's what's called Standard, which is basically the cards that have come out in the past like couple years. It's kind of like a rotating or constantly evolving window. And then they have Legacy. And if you're playing a Legacy tournament, you are playing with people that are using, like, could be using cards from 1993 to now. And that's a really interesting thing to see. Mm-hmm. And you're also looking at people playing with cards that have values of, like, potentially, like, $10,000. Which is crazy for a piece of cardboard, but
yes,
they do exist.
That's one of the things I think I find like about Magic, even though I don't play it or particularly care for it at this point, which is the history there. The fact that it's been around for long enough that it's gone through so many phases, so many cards are illegal in tournaments or just gone altogether. And it's just, it's interesting to look over the 21-year history of this game and see how it's changed.
Yeah, one quick thing I want to mention, sorry, some of the illegal cards that like they made and then realized shortly after, like, oh, this was a bad idea. Most of them are very early cards, but one of my favorite ones is called Chaos Orb. And with the Chaos Orb, you took the card and you held it a certain number of feet above the table and then just threw it up in the air, and whatever it landed on was destroyed. Like, this is an actual Magic the Gathering card. And they quickly were like, wait a minute, this is... And actually, the first edition of Magic, which they killed this very quickly after. It might have been second or third, maybe fourth edition. I can't remember when. But there was an anti-system, where basically when you started a game, you flipped over the top card of your deck. And whatever it was your bet. And if you lost the game, you lost that card. That went away very quickly.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
But
is it like beer pong? Like, are there house rules? Like, certain people still play by that, or certain people like the chaos orb, so they just fling it at people every time?
There are people that will do that. The illegal is only in terms of tournaments and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. I didn't expect, like, magic police were going to show up at your door. Like, are you using the chaos orb in there?
They absolutely will.
Open this
also,
door.
Also the tickle police.
Yes. Oh, God, no. Never, I will not violate the magic rules.
But just to clarify, I did talk some kind of smack against CCGs, but they are a great thing. They've been around for decades, and they have their place. They're just not for everybody, and I love what Fantasy Flight's doing to kind of shake up the model.
Well, I'll talk smack about CCGs. They suck. Okay.
End of episode.
But I wanna,
cut the feed.
In the past couple weeks, it's been super interesting because... Luke asked me to bring over the Game of Thrones card game, which we previously played a while back. And since that night, myself, Luke, Tony, and Brian have become... Oh, and Daniel.
Hey.
Have become steadily more obsessed and fall into the rabbit hole that is this game. And I'm curious, Luke, what do you think now that you are a guy who goes to comic book stores and buys card packs to build your deck? How do you feel about yourself now?
Nerd.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I would have done that with other games. It just wasn't... I don't know. Like, I love Agricola. If Agricola had some sort of thing that I needed to go buy, I would be down for that. I like that game enough. I don't know. It doesn't strike me as any different than...
But what about Game of Thrones? What about this game is one that bit you like that?
I don't know. I think we all kind of got excited about it at the same time. But part of it is that we all watched the show together and we're all, you know, interested in the world. I don't know, it just seems like a really well-designed game, and I enjoy playing it, and I enjoy playing it with my friends. I think it's just as simple as that. It's not anything...
No, I think it's deeply-seated psychological stuff, and I think that's what Jacob's trying to get at. So stop withholding, goddammit. This is an intervention. Luke, this should be an intervention.
I would tell you if I knew what it was.
Which house do you play, Luke?
I play Baratheon.
My accountant, and by that I mean the internet web face from my bank, is very upset with me and wants to have an intervention because I keep throwing money down a hole to get these expansion packs.
All right, so real quickly, since we know Luke plays Baratheon, who do you play, Daniel?
I play House Martell.
And who do you play, Tony?
I have two different decks of Targaryen, and I just started a Greyjoy.
Ryan?
I actually play House Stark, and I just bought this awesome... Oh, he's already dead. Never mind. Fuck. Always happens.
And I'm House Lannister, so it's fun that we all get to play our own different houses. And we reached a point now where we just all started sharing cards. Like, I gave all my Baratheon cards to Luke. Yeah, whenever they buy new cards, give me all their Lannisters, and we just have this big shared game now. And it's actually, as somebody who's always in the past been so possessive of my game collection, it's actually really freeing to sort of group own a game now. It feels really nice.
This has become one of my favorite things, actually, because it's, you know, every time someone gets a new pack, it's like, it's another Christmas. It's like, what do I get out of it? And what do I get to give to other people? And it's, honestly, if anyone out there has a couple of friends and you're thinking about, like, oh man, maybe I would play this Game of Thrones game, or Netrunner, or really any of these other living card games. Do it. It's a great, great, great way to get all of the things you want, and make other people happy too.
It's like a card game meets socialism.
Yes.
Yes.
It's kind of the same idea as drafting. Like, you know, typically you only play cards from your decks, or from your house, so like if I buy an expansion pack, it may only have 3 or 4 Baratheon cards that I'm interested in, but it's got 3 or 4 Martell cards, yeah, and 3 or 4 Lannister cards, and then there are neutral cards and plot cards that we can all kind of look through and say, all right, well, I bought this deck, so I'm taking this one, fuck you, but the rest of them have at it.
Well, one of the other great things about it, too, is that, you know, since it's a living card game, we know what's in every pack ahead of time.
Sure.
So it's like, Jacob, I really, really want to get the Maesters of the Citadel pack. It'll have this card for you, it'll have this card for me, let's do it. And it's great, because you know ahead of time, it's not like buying a booster pack where it's like, it's a surprise, oh, I guess here's Jaime Lannister, Jacob.
Wait, we know that? Because I don't know. Like, I mean, I go online, and there's a couple of sites that are like, here are some recommended packs for House Stark, but it still only says, like, here's one or two of the cards that you want out of it, and it doesn't tell you if that's all the Stark cards, or...
Oh, no, you can go and look at the packs and see exactly what comes in each of them.
Did not know this.
Every single pack.
Welcome to the internet!
Blindly chucking money at the wall.
There's a website called CardGameDB that lists all of the expansion packs.
Thanks for telling me that.
Every card.
You assholes.
Your deck's good enough that when I buy packs, I go through and look at all of the start cards, and I'm like, oh, Brian doesn't need that, and then I set it on fire.
See, I feel like there is some underhanded shit going on here. It's like, no, Brian, you should totally buy this expansion pack. It's got a lot of great...
It's got
Stark curse.
Valerion the Black, which you totally need for me.
Well,
you sons of bitches.
The great thing is when she sets the cards on fire, she also sets on fire your really nice card sleeves.
Jakaris.
Yeah. Oh, that's the best part.
Jakartis.
That is the best part, is not only are we buying the cards, but we're buying special sleeves for each one of them, because, as aforementioned, uber nerds.
Well, what we should do, actually, I want to propose this. We need to take a picture of each one of the card sleeves all together, put that up on the thing, and then have mine with fucking nothing, because there's not a Martell card sleeve.
They don't make a Martell card sleeve.
They don't make a Martell card sleeve.
You should just get a really obnoxious, like, teeny bopper anime character Hello Kitty one, just to, like, really fuck up the aesthetic of everything that's going on.
Is there a Hello Kitty living card game? Because that would kind of be amazing.
There probably is, but Dragon's Lair
probably
has
card sleeves.
The sleeves.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the Kickstarter for this? It's
for Hello Kitty living card game?
Oh, it's worse. It's a, it's a deck building game where sexy Japanese anime Nazis are trying to march through Europe, and you play as the these big titted anime Nazis. And
where can I give it my money?
Anyway, big tits.
So pretty much, and Nazis. So it's like literally there's like, sure. There's like the Lady Hitler card and the Lady Rommel card, and they're all like these cleavage Nazi anime girls giving like the peace sign on while riding panzers.
What is this game called again?
I don't remember the title. It's like Kickstarter, and it made me so embarrassed to be in this hobby.
You shouldn't be. It sounds amazing.
That is worth your money and time.
Anyway, so there's a Hello Kitty card game, but that I know about, there is a anime Nazi game.
Good.
Progress.
So deck building.
Deck building.
Luke, your deck's insane. As you there's six different houses, and you play House Baratheon, and you choose to include other cards from other houses in your deck. While paying a gold penalty, you want to do something, yet your cards often cost more. So I'm curious, at one point in your deck building, did you realize, I'm going to go above and beyond the Call of Duty, start writing everything down in charts, and build it like a madman?
All right, those are two separate questions. First of all, I'm a very simple guy, and I didn't know a lot about this game, so when I set out to build a new deck, I just Googled what are the best Game of Thrones card games, cards, period. And took several lists, and I was like, okay, these are the cards that are coming up a lot, but they're not in my house. So I started looking into, like, how do you play out-of-house cards? And it's like, okay, well, you can play an out-of-house card, but it costs more gold. But there's also a plot card you can use, where for a round, you can play out-of-house cards without a gold penalty. So it's just, you know, it's kind of like figuring out which cards go together to form a strategy. And Card Game DB is really helpful for that. It has pages for every card. And it's just as simple as looking in the comments, because, like, there are people that have done this for years. The Game of Thrones card game has been around since, like, 2003.
Yeah.
So it's not quite as old as Magic, but it's still 10 years old. You know, there are people that have been doing this for a decade, and they know the cards really well, and they know the expansions, and they keep track of that. And that's great that they do, and I'm going to profit from their knowledge. it's just a basic card that you may be looking at to include in your deck. You know, you scroll down to the comments, and it's, you know, 10 people saying, oh, I really like this card, it'll go really well with this card. And so you click, you know, it's kind of the rabbit hole where you click through and say, all right, I see how these cards can play together. You know, maybe I'll build a strategy around that. And then you had another question, and I have forgotten what it was.
Your charts.
Oh, my chart. Okay, it was just a way to keep things organized for me. And I also use two different plot cards that say, search your deck for. And sometimes if I'm looking for something specific, it's a lot easier to look at my list and go, all right, that's what that card is called, and that's what it does, and that's the one I want, than to be like, here's all 70 of my cards, and I'm going to look through them real slow, because I know there's one in here that does something, but I don't remember what it's called. You don't want to be that guy.
That was the day where I realized how serious our group game had gotten, because, like, I have my new finely tuned deck and bring it to your house. I sit down, I look over your chair, and you have everything written out. And I'm like, oh, someone's taking this far more seriously than I am.
Well, and I will say, actually, the first reason why I started writing things out was just to balance things, because, you know, you're supposed to have, so the minimum for a deck in Game of Thrones is 60. You can have 60 cards. You have to have 60 cards. You have to have more than 60 cards. And you typically try and keep it between 60 and 70. I'm actually playing a little more at the moment, but it was more like, all right, I want 10 attachments.
Nobody's,
you know,
nobody's
going to
make the big deck joke.
Oh, yes.
Well, it's all about deck measuring.
With a big deck at the moment. Yeah.
deck.
But it was just a way to be able to keep track of what I was doing, you know, and say, okay, so, you know, here are the attachments that I want to play, here are the locations I want to play, and that leaves me, you know, X amount of cards for characters or whatever. So.
And what is, when you're building your deck, did you end up having a grand overall strategy? Like my deck, for example, my Lannister deck, is all about finding a weak spot and pummeling it and destroying people's options. That's,
sure.
That's what I built mine around. Is there a certain area where you built yours around, or do you want to have a well-rounded deck?
What I really looked for were cards that had all three icons. So there are, you know, there are three aspects to every card. There's a military aspect, an intrigue aspect, and a power aspect. And cards that have all three are kind of rare, but there are attachments or there are locations that can, and event cards that can give you, you know, an extra icon. And so my deck was kind of built around what are the strongest cards and how can I have the most, you know, well-rounded, you know, having all three icons and having powerful cards that could stand on their own in a small way, you know, if Daniel plays Valar Morghulis and kills everybody's characters, and everybody needs to get back out.
Hey,
there.
Did you know that's Valyrian for All Men Must Die?
I did know.
Because I learned that this week. I just thought it was some, to quote Pulp Fiction, I just thought it was some badass shit to say to somebody before you light their ass up. But
which it is.
It is. But it's actually part of that language.
So yeah, that's kind of where I was at. And I will say, actually, again, I keep going back to Card Game DB, but it's a really cool site, and it has an online deck builder that you can use. So, like people like Tony who are trying to build multiple decks and keep
at
track
work.
Of them.
I mean, no, not at work.
It has a really nifty online deck building system where you can, you know, keep several decks and make an account or a profile or whatever, and then search for cards based on any number of criteria. You can filter out, you know, by house, by strength, by icons, by traits, keywords. So if there are things that you're really specifically looking for, you know, that's a good way to go about it. And I will say, like, you know, somebody like you who's got a strategy to their deck, I like my deck, and I think my deck plays fairly well, but there are always, especially in sparring, like sparring with Daniel or sparring with you, it comes out that my deck doesn't have a strategy, and as a result, I'm like, I feel like especially plot cards are the type of thing that I would maybe change up before each round. Like, knowing what you guys' deck is built towards, plot cards in particular is a quick and easy area where you could make some changes and kind of focus your deck a little more.
I mean, I don't know how much of this is for the layman and how much of this is for people actually playing the game, but the plot card at the beginning of every single round is something that each player throws out, and it determines how much gold they can spend, how much initiative they have, so who's going to go first, and then their claim, which comes into play when you win a military battle or when you're claiming power. It tells you how many people you kill or how many power you claim. But in addition to that, there's also an event printed underneath it that says, like, for this round, no one can declare a military challenge, or for this round... You know, and that's the thing, is it could be something specific to just you. Like, hey, Tony plays this plot card that says for this round she doesn't have to spend any gold on anybody, which would be great for her because she never gets to spend gold on anybody.
it's so true.
Or it might say something like nobody can declare an intrigue challenge on anybody else because there's basic phases to this game. You put out your plot card, you determine who goes first. They decide whether they want to be the hand of the king or the master of coin, and all of these things come with, like, either you know, an enhancement to their military strength or their intrigue strength or a couple more pieces of gold or an extra card to draw. And then after that, you determine how much gold you have, and that allows you to buy different you know, either characters or events or settings. And then once you've bought everything, then you decide, well, I'm going to initiate challenges. And there's three types. There's military, there's power, and there's intrigue. And then you just go through and decide if you want to attack people based on military, intrigue, or power. And then that's pretty much how it's played. So when Luke is talking about plot cards, he's basically talking about the opening of the opening round that determines a lot of how the rest of that round will play out.
And what's super interesting with the plot cards, and what I think the way they make this different from a lot of other LCGs and similar card games, is that in your hand, you'll hopefully have a combo of cards you can play that will bounce off each other. And plot cards mean you essentially have two decks. You have your large deck full of characters, locations, and events that you can play and hopefully get good things. But you have a small deck of 7 plot cards, which you always know what they are. So you can find cards that interact and can combo together. So in a way, you're using one smaller deck to set up combos. You can use your larger deck to bounce off of that. I've never seen a game use that quite like that before.
It's really great because it's an aspect of the game like that you're always in control of. Like, if you play that at the wrong time, that's your own fault. But if you, like, have, like, a really great combo of this round I play this plot card, next round this one, next one, next round this one, and it wins you the game, that's like your big master stroke. It makes you feel real good.
Real good.
Real good.
I want to hear Tony's deck-building stories because, at this point, Brian has a deck that kicks our ass. I have a deck that kicks people's asses. Daniel's deck is fucking evil, and Luke's is a beast. I know, Tony, you've been trying a lot of different things. How is your deck right now?
I have. So my deck started as just the plain Targaryen deck, which I really liked, and I wanted to play it because dragons, obviously. And then I went on CardGameDB. They should give us some royalties or something for all the advertising that we're doing for
them. This episode brought to you by CardGameDB, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, seriously. So I went there, and I was looking up some... Definitely not at work. I was looking up some good strategies, and one of them was just a pure Dothraki deck. And we had started getting a couple of expansions, and I had some good Dothraki cards that could play off of each other. But I went home, and I think I played... the Dothraki with a couple of dragons because, I mean, I couldn't leave out the dragons, and it just did not work for me at all. It was pretty terrible. And so I kind of honed it down, and now I have a pure Dothraki deck. And
you
a
cut
pure,
out the dragons?
Yeah, I have a pure dragon Targaryen.
Racist.
Yeah, right?
Separating the dragons and the Dothraki.
Well, they're separate decks, but they're equal decks, so it's fine.
Sure they are.
And both of them are based on just... pure ball busting power. It's not my big thing. Is my drawback is that I don't have enough money ever. If I'm doing a spar, I've been able to beat Luke a couple times. I've never been able to beat Jacob in any one-on-one, and I don't think I've played you, Daniel.
No, we haven't played yet, which is strange.
Yeah, or you, Bri.
Nope.
Daniel, your deck. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Oh, I was like, I want to. Speaking of Daniel's deck, you told me your strategy for your deck. I want you to repeat to the audience what your deck does to people.
My deck, as a Martell deck, and if you know anything about, you know, any of the Game of Thrones lore, this works out really well. My deck punishes you for doing well against me.
That's diabolical.
It makes you think twice about doing anything that could net you any real forward momentum.
Or before you give your heart away. And I know all the games you play because I play them. Like, literally, I play them too. That's why we're doing this podcast. What were we talking about?
We're talking about everyone's specific deck strategies. You heard from Luke, Tony, and Daniel. So, Brian, what is your deck strategy? Do you have one?
Get some more fucking intrigue is my new deck strategy because militarily and power-wise, nobody can touch my fucking deck. Like, those every Stark character is just bred for war. And it's great. Except that I have, like, I had so... And they're so cheap. Like, I literally have a card that costs me 0 and gives me 5 strength.
Yeah, that's my problem, is I've got so many... Yeah. I've got so many good cards that if I could just fucking play them. Yeah. And I can't, because I almost never have anything that's gold-generating, and I've got a lot of...
Location.
Yeah, I've got a lot of locations that either get me 1 gold or get me a couple off of my next Targaryen card, but... I never seem to have them in the right place at the right time, and so I'm about 3 or 4 rounds behind everybody else when they start playing everything, and I'm just getting pummeled before I can get all my big cards out. So I haven't learned to be patient and play the slow game, but that's what I'm going to try. That's my strategy next time. Sorry, B. Go on.
No, narratively, it makes sense that the Starks don't have a lot of intrigue because that's a house of very straightforward people who aren't sneaky and don't kind of, you know... don't do things that are underhanded. So I get why there's not a lot of intrigue in the Stark deck, but it does make me vulnerable to those type of attacks. And almost without fail, the only cards in the Stark deck that have any intrigue are the female characters. And the problem there is that those female characters don't have a lot of actual, like, strength. So I always run into this problem where I'm like...
Sexist.
No, like, literally printed on the card, they don't have a lot of strength.
You're being so sexist.
You're a sexist with your ways. No, but so I have these female characters that only have, like, one or two strength total who are also representing my entire presence of intrigue. So I've gone through and I'm looking for... And this is... I stayed away from playing a lot of direwolves because they don't really do anything unless you have a lot of lords and ladies in play because they'll either add strength to one of them or they'll keep them from getting killed. Like, there's literally direwolves that if you attach it to a Stark lord or a Stark lady, if you're attacked militarily and you lose, that character should die, but instead I can just discard the direwolf and that character remains. So, I mean, because I've noticed, you know, over the last couple of games that intrigue has been my weak point, not only do I have to add more female characters with intrigue, but that means I also have to add more direwolves to bump up their individual strength. So it's not just one thing that I add. I have to, because I'm adding that, I have to add this other thing. It's like if you give a mouse a cookie and then try to take its head in battle, it's going to want a direwolf. I'm not sure. I lost the thread of what I was talking about.
But it's interesting you talk about the direwolves because I'm helping my fiance build a Stark deck right now. And when we sit down to build it, we built the entire thing around Stark Lords, Stark Ladies, and Direwolves. See, the goal of our deck is to get Direwolves and Lords out as fast as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. We don't have as many armies as you do. We don't have the sheer force that your deck has.
Right.
But she has a situation where she can have Catelyn Stark riding a Direwolf wielding ice. So
yeah, that's the other thing is there's a lot of attachments, like a certain sword or just, you know, something that they've come up like story-wise, like, oh, like a bodyguard, for example. There's a card that you can add. Doesn't cost you anything. You can add to a lord or a lady character that, again, will take the bullet. If there's ever an event card that says specifically, like, this person must die, you can just discard the bodyguard and that person stays up, so.
But also, you describing the whole give a mouse cookie analogy is really
interesting. Was that an analogy? I felt like I was just rambling.
No, it makes sense.
That makes sense.
Because the whole idea is, like, you find a great card. You find a weak spot in your deck. It supplies a magic as well. And you go, oh, I want to slide this to my deck. Oh, but I can make it more powerful with this. And suddenly your Svelte 62 card deck is now 75 cards. Yep. You go, oh no, it's too fat.
I'm
work
at
anymore.
75, yeah. And it's been tough to keep it at 75.
Well, no, that's exactly what happened to me when I started getting the Sand Snake cards. Because every Sand Snake card.
Were you playing the Beetlejuice card game?
That's a Sand Snake.
He's playing the Dune card game.
Yeah, right, I'm playing on. The Dune card game. The Sand Snakes are. The Red Viper's bastard daughters. And the great thing about them is they all work together. Like, if I'll have one card out that says, all right, when this card is out, all Sand Snake characters get an intrigue icon. Then I'll put another one out. Okay, all Sand Snake characters now have a military icon and deadly. Yeah. And another one out, and they keep stacking to the point where every Sand Snake character has every icon, is deadly, is stealthy,
yep.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's another thing, too. Pro tip, make sure you read all of the text under the characters. And not only that, but like keep track of that shit, because there was at one point a game we played the other night where like the arrangement of characters and locations and event cards that I had played, I had to go through and like, okay, his starting strength is 3. He gets a +1 from that, a +2 from that, a +3 from that. So, okay, and it was like, it was mind-boggling to try and, like, add up all this shit.
Well, and, like, the thing is, you know, like I was saying, like, you know, I started playing with all these Sand Snake characters, and clearly I needed, like, 2 or 3 copies of each of them. So I threw those into my, you know, nice 61-card deck, and that ballooned. But then I found an attachment that gives the Sand Snake ability to any other character. So I could take that and take my other powerful characters.
And do more fucking
and
math.
Yes. But, like, that's the thing. It does. It balloons out of control, like, once you find all of the cool things you can do.
And then despite all that, you have no fucking intrigue.
But and then once again, like with Tony's thing, you know, earlier she's like, well, it's like, I want to build a Dothraki deck, but I also want dragons. And so you put these things together and you think they would do really well together, but they don't.
They sure don't.
Because you've added too many things.
Well, as you may have noticed from our discussion, Paul has never played the game with Conan's card game.
I've never played it, so I don't know.
So I'm curious, what's kept you away from it? Or has there just been anything in any reason, or is it just because you haven't gotten around
to it? What's wrong with you?
I was originally just honestly turned off by the whole fact that I'm all about efficiency and playing a game to its most efficient, like, possibilities. So when I found out that the game, like, the core set only comes of, like, one of each card, and to really have an efficient deck, you would need four copies of the core set to have four copies of each kind of a card.
To be fair, I've combined my core set with Tony's core set, and we were all doing pretty fine.
Well, y'all are in a special situation where you've got like five people to trade.
The general advice that is given to most people getting into the game, and I haven't read a whole lot about this game at all in the past couple weeks, but to just have fun with your friends, one core set should suffice. Okay. To make a deck that works out of just out of core set things, two sets of the core set are perfect. You don't need any more than that. After that, just buy chapter packs, buy the box sets of the different houses that aren't included in the core set, which I know those all come with three copies of every card, which is great.
Yeah.
Because you don't need more than that.
I think my I probably will one day try this game out. My personality is a little different with the history of card games I've played. Mm-hmm. I get bored of a deck real quick. I'll like play a deck like three or four times and be like, okay, I'm going to deconstruct that, make something completely different now, a completely different, you know, like, I don't want to say race, but house or whatever, like in a different kind of game. But like, all right, now I'm going to play this all of a sudden. So it's like I'm playing the Star Wars card game and I'm buying and keeping all of the cards.
Well, the really good thing about this is that I have played probably half a dozen, maybe 10 games in the past 2 weeks, and I have never once gotten through my entire deck.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that you only keep 7 cards in your hand at all times, and it's very limited.
You can have more than that.
Have
you been playing wrong?
I don't know. You guys don't tell me shit.
At the beginning, you have 7.
At the beginning, you start with 7. My point is, there aren't a lot of situations. You're not constantly grabbing from your whole cards. Like, they can sit there. I've had games where half my deck just sits there because I don't have as many opportunities.
Because you usually only draw 2 cards every round.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think the
typical game, you only end up using maybe 20, 25 of your
cards. Depending on where they end up in the shuffle, you may be playing, even though you know everything in your deck, you may end up playing a different subset of that deck every time.
So you're playing a different game against that rat bastard Lannister every single time.
Well, and then also, one of the interesting things as well that I think you may enjoy is that, you know, Tony was talking about earlier how she had a dragon deck and then she had a Dothraki deck. I know Jacob has had he's working on a Clansman deck now?
A Clansman deck, yes.
So a Lannister deck using specifically Tyrion's Clansmen as opposed to Knights and, you know, things like that.
Just real quick, when we say those are all keywords that are printed in bold on the cards, and they're event cards and plot cards and different aspects of the game that will do things specifically for characters that have those keywords. Like Daniel was saying with his Sand snake characters.
Like Rob Stark is a card where in the event under Rob Stark says that I can name any trait, and whoever, you know, in my play, you know, in my cards in play, whoever has that trait gets like a +2 to strength. So like if I have a lot of armies, hey, army. If I have a lot of lords, lord is the trait that will get this extra boost. So
I don't Paul saying though, because is like right now I have my deck, I'm comfortable with it, I'm happy with it, and I'll change if it stops working or if someone counters it beautifully. But at the same time, like, I can imagine playing with this enough times, getting enough combinations where I just want to try something new.
My personality of just like, I'm kind of scared of the game, because again, I got into the Star Wars Fantasy Flight game at the right time, because I got it when there was just the core set, and now I've been buying the expansions, and it's no more than one a month, so it's like, okay, $15 a month, easy. But this game kind of terrifies me, because it's like, oh, that's like $1,000 to have it all. Like, and that's just how my brain works. Yeah. Like, gotta catch them all.
Well, I guess what I was getting at before was that even being like, say, locked into a house, you can play completely different types of decks every time you're playing.
Yeah,
and then outside of that, you know, obviously you can play.
So based on what you said about getting into Star Wars at the perfect time, does that mean you're not going to get into this card game until 30 years after the show is off the air? Because Star Wars has been out for, like, No.
I'm just, the game just came out, last year.
Okay. I thought you meant you just got into Star Wars.
No. I just mean the card game.
Star Wars?
Fantasy Flight just got the license to it, and they've released a few games, including a really cool role-playing game that I want to get together sometime. Maybe we should do. Anyway.
Paul, would you like to host the future episode of the Diecast where you play the Star Wars RPG?
That would be cool. All
right, moving on. Keep on.
So they just released it. And again, same company that made this, and, I've been really loving that game a lot. I've been playing it with my girlfriend and then a couple other friends as well. And we've been playing a little differently than y'all. We just kind of get together and build our decks like 10 minutes before we start playing. There's a lot less strategy. However, the Star Wars game, the deck building is actually a lot more simplified, where you have objective sets. So you have what these cards that are called objectives, and then there's 5 cards that go with them. And you can't break them up. Mm. So, and you have 10 objectives in your deck. So when you're building your deck, you just are picking the 10 options that you think work best together. There's still tons of strategy in it, but you can build an efficient deck like pretty quickly.
It's really cool. I haven't played Star Wars as much as you do, but it makes it so like I really just draw a Vader card, but I don't want the other 4 cards with it. So it forces you to like almost, if you want to use the writer's term, kill your darlings.
Yeah,
that makes you. And forces you to build efficiently rather than build cards that you just think are cool.
Yeah, and it really, like, making a change to your deck, you know, you play a game and you're like, this objective set isn't working. I just changed up 6 cards in my deck, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just by unplugging and plugging in. And it does a really interesting thing. They call it, I can't remember what it's called. It's something like narrative battles or... we're basically like you're in a battle, and it can essentially be like a Tauntaun fighting a Star Destroyer. But they say it's not literal. That like the way the story is working is that because this Tauntaun did something on Hoth, it's affecting what's happening in space. It's like kind of a butterfly flaps its wings. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like some hippy dippy bullshit, Paul.
But it's really fun.
What do you think Yoda is?
And maybe I could bring it over. I'll bring it over sometime, and we can all play with my cards. I think you guys would enjoy it. But it also uses, like this game has different houses. It has, there's the two, you know, dark side and the light side, but then there's different factions. So there's like...
Damn it, splitting it up by race again.
Spies and smugglers, the rebellion Jedi, and then on the dark side there's the scum and villainy, the Imperial Navy.
Wait, the smugglers are on the light side?
Yeah, smugglers. Like
Han Solo and Chewbacca. Yeah, those good smugglers.
They're hiding from the Empire.
Smuggling all those drugs.
Yeah.
You know.
I haven't played as much as you have, but I've always been an Imperial Navy guy. I love playing with those cards.
Just like Yoda told us.
One of the interesting things is their first set of... they're only on the second set like of expansions. Does Game of Thrones do like a set of expansions?
Where they do,
Okay, so they're only on the second set for Star Wars. The first set was all Hoth. And the second set is Expanded Universe, which was like an interesting choice for them to go with, especially now that it's all being thrown out the window in terms of canon. But it's all like Mara Jade and like stuff like that from the books.
That disappoints me because I don't like EU stuff. I like stuff from the movies, damn it.
Well, you can just skip that set.
Exactly, yeah.
But anyway, it's a very cool game. I do need to try this one of these days. But, you know, I think it's like any game. It's like any card game, you will... pick it up and start playing it when you have friends that are playing it. I really didn't know many people playing this game, and I didn't even realize y'all were playing it that seriously until recently. And I think that's just kind of any card game, really. You can buy a whole bunch of Magic cards, but if you don't have anybody to play with, you're just going to be sitting there looking at your Magic cards.
You know, as a kid, I had friends that played it, and I tried so many times to teach myself how to play that game, and I never was able to do that. And in fact, later on, I got like this Empire Strikes Back Star Wars. I don't know if it was an expansion or if it was its own separate card game. But
it was its own. Yeah.
I tried to play that, and again, I'm just looking at all these like colored symbols and like all this stuff, and I couldn't figure it out. And then it's funny because I didn't think that I would enjoy the Game of Thrones card game for that same reason, because I've always found that traditionally I have a hard time getting into the rules of these games. But I kind of feel like this one's been simplified. I mean, it's just by having the basic phases, just reading what's on the card and going strictly by the numbers. It's actually a pretty basic game.
Like, it's far more intuitive than Magic is. Mm-hmm. Magic is, Magic's been lauded for its design, and rightfully so, because it didn't influence every other card game out there, including Game of Thrones. But I think over the years, the design has gotten bloated, whereas I think that Game of Thrones is still easy to dive into.
Also, with Magic, while it can add things, it sticks to its core elements and can't change those. So while other games have learned from Magic and been able to build on upon them and look at the problems with them and stuff like that, Magic can't go and change its core elements because it's got a 20-some-odd-year history. So the problems that it has will always be there. There's a classic problem in Magic where you basically have to play these lands that let you tap for mana. You get mana from them. And there's a classic term called mana screwed, which is if you just don't draw the lands, you're not going to win. That's it. It's game over. Like, you're just sitting there. You just keep drawing, and you randomly shuffle, and all your lands are at the bottom of your deck. It's over. The game's over in 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And that's just like a classic problem with Magic. Something really interesting that the World of Warcraft game, which is out of print now, did to build on that, which I thought was even better than Magic. It wasn't nearly as popular of a game. But they actually made it so any card could be used as a resource. So if you, you know, had a card that was, you know, a really powerful, you know, fighter or whatever, but you just had to get more resources, you could sacrifice them and use it as a resource. That's, you know, and so there is no mana screw in that game. But anyway, but yeah.
Is it really called mana fuck?
I don't know. I've always heard it mana screw. I mean, I think if you called it mana fucked, everybody would understand, but, you know.
It's interesting that, like, the Game of Thrones card game on other LCGs have found ways to get around that as well, like we talked about the plot cards earlier. In Game of Thrones, unless you play a card that gives you zero gold and you choose to play that card, you will always be getting more resources every turn, so you're never out of it entirely.
Star Wars is similar, too. You start out with resources, things like... I mean, Magic is... You know, Magic, you start out with nothing, and it's what you draw. And so that's what can be so tough. But yeah, Star Wars,
You start from the bottom, and then you get here.
Yeah. And,
yeah, it's a drink.
One last thing I want to mention about Star Wars, which is really cool, and I don't know if Game of Thrones... does Game of Thrones have multiple play styles, like multiple formats?
There's 2-on-2 and there's Melee, which is the multiplayer game.
Okay. So Star Wars is similar to that. So Star Wars has 1-on-1, and then they recently added with an expansion 2v2. Mm-hmm. And then also... So there's 2v2, which is just like you're on a team together. And in the team game, it's actually really interesting. You can like pass cards between each other in like a special format and like be able to... So you can structure your decks to work together, which is cool. And then they also have 3v1. Where one person play, they have these two like superpowered decks. Like the dark side one is you're building the second Death Star, and one person plays this ultra powerful deck, and the other three people try and destroy them. So it's got some pretty cool formats in there.
I'm not gonna lie, that's what a lot of our 4-player games end up being.
Just kind
of everybody against Jacob.
Yeah, I'm torn on Game of Thrones 4-player. I think 1-on-1's a brilliant game. I think that a 3-player game is fast enough that it works out perfectly. But in my experience, in a 4-player game, there's always somebody I've seen happen to almost everyone at this table who gets hit so hard, so fast, and so often that, and the 4-player game is so long, if they're out for the count so early, it stops being fun for that person. I guess that's my one problem with it, is I don't like playing.
Well, you did pick the goddamn Lannisters. I mean, I don't know what you expected, man.
But it has happened to all of us.
Yeah,
it has not happened to me.
I feel awful because the first time it happened was happened for Tony, and in the course of a 3.5-hour long game, because a 4-player game can go long if you let it. She couldn't get anything out, and I felt awful. I stopped having fun because she wasn't having fun.
That is kind of a drawback. If everybody else has a bunch of characters out and you get whittled down, it's tough to get characters out because you know they're just going to die. Okay. And, you know, I don't know. It's a tough thing to get multiple characters out to the point that you can have one go on to the next round. So
in Game of Thrones,
that's where Valar Morghulis comes in.
I was about to say I just reset everything.
All men must stop being dicks.
And like I said, I adore the game. I just feel like 4-player can tend towards somebody getting ganged up on, and I wish there was a way to fix it, and a way to fix it is have a better deck. But,
yeah.
But at the same time, like even when I get my ass kicked in a 3-player game, the game's fast enough, and I feel my options are always there. Whereas in a 4-player game, I just don't think it's as fun.
But like 3-player games. Yeah, I think those are ideal.
We haven't tried the 2-on-2 yet, where two houses team up against two more.
That sounds like a lot of
fun. Yeah, we should try that for sure.
That's what I really enjoy that in Star Wars a lot, because in Star Wars you not only can you do that, you can even defend for the other person. So a lot of your strategy happens with like working with the other person, going like, okay, I'm going to attack with this person, and then I'll use this person to defend against, and so on and so forth. And another interesting thing, and I don't know if this is how Game of Thrones works, but in Star Wars, the phases, when you're playing like 2v2, like phases are like split up and things like that. So it's like, okay, this phase happens, then this phase happens. And so you're almost constantly like doing something. You're not sitting there waiting for three other people to go. You're like constantly reacting and interacting and that sort of thing. But not, again, not trying to play Star Wars versus Game of Thrones, because that's not what I'm doing. It's just what my experience is with, and I haven't played this.
But real briefly, I want to start on, before we start running out of time, I want to start wrapping this up in the next few minutes. The other Fantasy Flight LCGs, I know you played the Call of Cthulhu one, right, Paul?
I've played it like 2 times, and I don't want to, I never like talking bad about a game. It didn't super intrigue me.
Yeah, that one hasn't taken off quite like some of the others. And I love the theme, I love Fantasy Flight's Arkham Horror games and their other Lovecraft games, but something about it has never seemed...
That game, the game you are, I played it years ago, so my memory of the exact rules might be wrong, so I'm sure the forum people can hate on me. But I remember you're not really so much playing against the other person as you're trying to gain objectives for yourself faster than the other person. So it felt less of like a battle and more of a just, I'm going to try and get this done first. And I don't know, wasn't super fun.
So Call of Cthulhu LCG, Paul does not recommend.
Well, yeah, sure.
Well, I guess we'll briefly go over some of the other LCGs that are available for case Game of Thrones or Star Wars aren't your cup of tea. But I highly recommend the Lord of the Rings LCG, which is really unique among these type of games because it's cooperative. You randomly build enemy deck, which will spawn creatures and monsters to attack you. And you have to build all of your own personal decks of heroes and events and all work together to survive the enemy deck. And it's super interesting. It's not as intuitive as Game of Thrones. I think it requires a little bit more of a learning curve, but it's totally unique. And if you definitely don't like it, Game of Thrones is so cutthroat and mean sometimes. And Star Wars, you know, it's possible that it's all about hurting each other. So when you look at Lord of the Rings, you know, it has a Lord of the Rings theme. You're all working together to defeat evil. And you know, I like to play as Sauron sometimes. Yeah, but but it's actually a friendly game, and you all suffer together when you lose. So it's actually has it. It's really fun. Has anyone else here played Lord of the Rings?
Mm-mm.
All right, moving on. the other one is Warhammer Invasion, which is a two-player... it starts off as a one-on-one Warhammer-themed card game. They have an expansion now where it can be 4 players. And it's okay. I want to try it again with maybe more people, but it's fine. That's all I'm going to say about it. But the real reason I'm going on this tangent is I want to tell you all guys about Netrunner, which is the current huge popular LCG. It's the new kid on the block, and it's... For a reason, it's hugely popular. It's sort of a dystopian sci-fi future where one player plays as a corporation, the other player plays as a hacker, and the table space is cyberspace, and you are literally playing programs and hacking tools, and you're literally battling each other's like security systems. And it's fantastic, and I think it's really intuitive. I think it's even easier to pick up than Game of Thrones. And every time you do something on the board, it feels thematically... Right, like sometimes in Game of Thrones, if you're big on theme like I am, sometimes like, oh, I don't know why my character would be doing this but in Netrunner, everything feels like it's gelling, so it's possible to lose yourself in it and feel like, wow, I actually, for an hour, I'm actually feeling like a hacker. Whereas in Game of Thrones, even at its best, like, oh, I'm doing Game of Thrones fan fiction. So, like I said,
I feel like a warlord.
I don't think anyone else here has played Netrunner, right?
No, I really want to.
Yeah, I've talked about it before in the podcast, yeah. And I would like to start introducing you guys to it, but there's a reason why it's so special. It's actually original design. It was originally came out in the 90s, and the new version is a reprint. It was designed by the same guy who designed Magic, and he designed Netrunner to be a card game that fixed Magic's problems. And it didn't take off, but it's taking off now, and it's really fantastic. A
completely different game design.
100% different, yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually an asymmetrical game where that corporation... has a completely different rule set than the hacker.
That's the same with Star Wars, too. With Star Wars, the light side is trying to do different things than the dark side, which is very interesting, like the asymmetrical gameplay, because you're playing with a completely different strategy than the other person, just by default, which is very cool. And Fantasy Flight doing this asymmetrical thing is the first time I've ever seen it in a card game.
A card game, yeah.
In a card game. Yeah. And that's very, very cool. They're really playing with the mold and just kind of throwing some new things in there to kind of a something that hasn't really been messed with in, you know, over a decade or more type of gameplay.
Yeah, I think that as popular as Magic is, I think I'm glad that the LCG world exists because Magic, like you say, can't change, whereas Fantasy Flight is saying, oh, this game doesn't appeal to you. If you don't like Warhammer Invasion, you'll like Lord of the Rings. So like, oh, you don't like fantasy? Here's Star Wars. Yeah. And they have the Harry Potter license, and they're still working on things with it. They haven't announced anything official, but I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 2 years you see a new Harry Potter LCG from Fantasy Flight.
That would be cool. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I think we start wrapping this show up. Paul, any final thoughts you want to share with people at home about card games in general?
There's one thing that we didn't get a chance to talk about that I just want to mention, and I'll keep it brief. Have you all heard about Hearthstone?
I have.
Yes.
No.
Okay. Hearthstone is an online card game. It's free to play. You can buy packs, but everything you could buy, you could earn just by playing the game and earning gold in-game. It's made by Blizzard, so it's like in the Warcraft universe, but you don't need to know anything about it other than it's just fantasy shit.
Check.
And, yeah, it'll play on pretty much any computer. It's also on
work computers.
Yeah. It's also on iPad as well. And it's really fun. The games last about 10 minutes, 15 minutes is one game. So it's a very, very quick kind of one-on-one card game. Deck size is only 30 cards. So, and you start out like with a whole bunch of decks already built, and then you start earning cards and modifying it and that sort of thing. I've been playing a bunch of that. It's a really fun thing just at the end of the day, jumping on and playing like a few games in a half hour. It's pretty fun. And if you know, like these kinds of card games and strategy, it's a really cool thing just to play with and see what it's all about. So I would recommend that.
Luke, would you have any final thoughts?
I think Paul's a nerd.
Well, yeah.
That's all. I am too.
Daniel, any final anecdotes, advice, or stories about Game of Thrones or other card games?
Let's see. I mean, honestly, the only thing I want to say here is that if anyone is considering, you know, playing one of these games, get a group together. Throw in the money and do it as a group, because this has been a really, really rewarding experience, because you have a built-in group of people you're going to play with, and it doesn't hurt the wallet as much, which is a big deal for me.
And if you're going to buy any of this stuff on Amazon, please come to oneofus.net first and click on any one of our links to get you to Amazon, because then whatever you buy benefits the site. Thank you very much.
How about you, Tony?
I just actually like to do a plug. My friend has an Etsy shop called Where Are My Dragons? And she is making me the nerdiest card carrier ever. She is knitting me a dragon that will carry my cards around. And I needed to give a little bit of love to her. So if you wanted to go to Etsy, Where Are My Dragons?
Will she make me a solid gold case for my Lannister deck?
No, she doesn't work with Lannister.
I was going to say, unless she's Rumpelstiltskin.
What about a son with a spear?
Yeah,
going
she can
it.
Do that okay, for cool. our allies. Yeah, Marcellus. Okay,
sweet.
How about you, Brian?
What? I agree with Daniel. I think this game specifically is one that is best played in a group because, as we mentioned before, when you're buying the expansion packs, there are going to be situations where your house only has four or so cards in that expansion pack. But if, you know, somebody else, somebody who's playing kind of in your guild, let's say, is playing a different house and they buy an expansion pack, they might have other things for your house, and then it just becomes a matter of trading, which actually, that weird sort of commerce aspect of it is almost like its own separate game. And there's kind of that second layer to it that's also a lot of fun. Like, building a deck can be really, really enjoyable. So, and again, this is stuff I never thought I would find myself saying. But yeah. Nerd indeed, but yeah, no.
I mean, y'all are catching. I was doing this. I was a nerd getting picked on when I was like 10.
Do you want me to give you a wedgie, Paul?
Are you going
to
be a nerd and a hipster?
I'm
going to
give y'all
right
wedgies now.
You're going to be a nerd and a hipster. Okay. But yeah,
is that on the record?
Yeah.
Really?
Wedgies?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, goddamn.
Well, my final thoughts are.
There you go, grammar.
That it. I don't know, as somebody who's been playing board games for a long time and is always out to try to get people involved in the hobby, it makes me so happy to see so many people who I care about really embracing the game.
Not you.
It's no longer a case of, I'll bring over some games and we'll play. It's a case of, them actively engaging with it on a level that I never thought I'd see my friends doing, and Game of Thrones card game did that, and it actually makes me feel like, oh, all the time I've spent trying to get people into this hobby is paying off in a way that my friends have discovered, like, something that I truly love, and it means a lot to me, so... I'm tearing up a little
how,
bit.
It how does it, how does it make you feel, Jacob, to bring this full circle?
Does it have all of the feels?
How does it make you feel? Here, well, let's hear a sound.
The opposite of air would be hair. Right?
That's very sweet, Jacob. I'm still going to crush you.
So we're all going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, right?
Yes.
Apparently
yes.
So.
So I'm no longer meh. I am now hair. And so it's, everyone, say your goodbyes.
Goodbye. I'm Brian. You can find me here at oneofus.net. You can find me on Twitter at BrianGuySalisbury or at Film School Rejects every Tuesday doing the Junk Food Cinema podcast with C. Robert Cargill.
And also at papabear.gov.
Apparently papabear.gov, which I didn't think the government would sponsor that kind of thing, but okay, sure.
I am Tony T.S. You can find me at the Peregrine, well, the underscore Peregrine. That underscore is pretty important on Twitter.
I'm Daniel Kalbacher, your regular co-host. You can find me at A Supersonic Man on the Twitters.
I'm Luke Mullen. I'm at LD Mullen on Twitter.
I'm Paul Gandersman. I'm at Paul underscore Gandersman, which I can't blame you for not spelling, so hopefully Brian will add it in the description
Yeah.
I'll take care of that. You want to play some Hearthstone online, I don't remember my handle on Battle.net right now. It's Arcanum something or other. So just tweet at me and I'll tell you.
And I'm Jacob Hall. On Twitter, I am at Jacob S. Hall. You can find me writing for ScreenCrush.com, Movies.com, and Fandango.com. And, of course, every week you'll be hearing me and the rest of these guys on oneofus.net. And thank you very much for tuning in, and go buy some LCGs.